All right, Alexander, let's do another update as to what is going on in Ukraine. And we could start out with what is going on the ground, though I don't think there's, I mean, there's fighting every day, but I don't think there's big activity happening, big moves taking
No,
place. And you may
I
want to
think that's
update everyone as.
exactly. I think that's exactly right. I think, by the way, that's what the Russians want at the moment. I think they want stability on the front lines whilst they're still training up these 300,000. Well, actually, it's apparently 380,000 men that they're enlisting into their forces. And when we talk about enlisting into their forces, I saw that an entire new paratroop brigade has apparently been created out of ex-paratroopers who've been called up again. So, I mean, you know, we're talking about a very, very major Russian build-up. Now, as you rightly said, there's not any sign of, major activity. There is occasional reports. Yesterday, I was reading a brief flurry of reports that the great Ukrainian offensive in Zaporozhye had begun, and Ukrainian channels were talking about this. But then it turned out that wasn't the case at all. What the Ukrainians have been doing is that they've been shelling the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant, which seems to be then another one of their particular obsessions. And but anyway, apart from that, there's been no very dramatic news. One gets reports. A Russian newspaper called Redovka said yesterday that the Russians have made more progress around Ugledar, that they're now gradually, cutting Ugledar's supply lines. There's some more reports that, things have quietened down on some of the other fronts in a way that the Russians like, that the Ukrainians are no longer counterattacking anymore. But the big battles at the moment are over. The big movements of troops backwards and forwards are over. Before I finish this summary, by the way, I just wanted to say something about Kherson. That's the area west of the Dnieper. Because if you remember, the Ukrainian military were constantly warning that the Russians were trying to draw Ukraine into a trap in Kherson. And I'm not saying that this is true, but you're getting some reports trickling out from Kherson west of the river, west of the Dnieper, which, sort of, collate with that in the sense that it seems that the Russians are carrying out continuous airstrikes on the Ukrainian troops west of the Dnieper. They're strung out across open fields. There's very little cover for them, and they're well within artillery range of Russian artillery east of the Dnieper. And Ukraine can't supply either its forces or what's left of the civilian population in Kherson region to an in Kherson city to an adequate degree. And now they're talking about evacuating the population, what's left of the population from Kherson region. Now, I don't want to overstress this, and this is a very, very scattered reports, but it did remind me a little bit of, that business with Snakes Island, which the Russians then abandoned. The Ukrainians tried to occupy. They found that they couldn't really occupy it. And it's not exactly the same because I'm sure the Ukrainians will maintain some kind of a presence in Kherson region. But it looks like it's a very uncomfortable one for them. So anyway, just mentioning that because you asked me about the situation on the ground and I thought I'd just mention it.
All right. There's also a lot of reports from the Russian side, from Donbass, where they're saying that there are more and more NATO troops under the guise of paid mercenaries and contract soldiers and stuff like this. And I was reading a report the other day of a group that the United States has created, or a U.S. company has created, to counter the Wagner Group, and they're calling it the Mozart Group, mercenaries, contract soldiers. So you're starting to get more reports of NATO troops, of contract soldiers. But either way, it seems to me like it's mission creep. Maybe it's a different kind of mission creep, because you're dealing with contract soldiers and NATO guys who are allegedly contract soldiers, but they're NATO military, according to the Russians. But it still feels like it's some sort of mission creep.
It is mission creep. That's exactly what it is. And if you go back to in historical time, if you go back to Vietnam, if you go back to other wars that the United States has been involved in, the pattern is exactly reproducing itself. And by the way, during the Iraq War, again, there was a period of time when I believe something like half the people under arms in Iraq were actually contractors. They weren't military. They weren't, you know, regular military. So I think an awful lot of this is going on. And the problem is, however much you internationalize the war in that way, I doubt that he can make up for the scale of the Russian build-up that's going on. I mean, the US can send thousands of contractors. The Russians can call up tens and hundreds of thousands of men. So there is already that problem. But secondly, of course, if you start losing these contractors, then and you start losing the war in that kind of way, because you know you're investing more and more people to fight for you and to make up for the problems that the Ukrainians have, well, the more you lose, the more the pressure on you grows to escalate even more, because your stake in the battle is increasing. And that's, I think, you know, we are now into that escalatory cycle. It's hardly been talked about in the media. It's certainly not been talked about in the British media. I mean, if you were reading the British media, you wouldn't know about these mercenaries hardly at all. You only learn about them when they're captured. So you don't get much talk about this, but it is a steady pattern of escalation, and it's very easy to see how it can all go hideously, horribly wrong eventually.
Right. Okay, so we have the New York Times. They ran an article the other day, and they confirmed the video with regards to the POWs and what Russia is alleging is a war crime. So the video has been confirmed. The New York Times, they stopped short of saying that Ukraine committed war crimes. I mean, they implied it, but they didn't just come out and say it. They interviewed various people. They verified the video. The New York Times, they qualified it by saying that they don't exactly know the nuances of the situation as to how this occurred. So that's how they kind of qualified it. But I think this is a significant step in the collective West's frustration with the war, but also with the Zelensky regime. Newsweek also ran an article, and they said that much of the collective West is getting very frustrated with Zelensky. They're very upset with his doubling and tripling, quadrupling down. He still hasn't admitted about the Ukraine missile in Poland. I mean, it seems like there is a faction, not everybody, because obviously Zelensky's not admitting that it was a Russian missile, because he's getting the orders from someone to not admit it. I mean, I'm convinced of that. Someone is telling him, don't come out and say it was us. But I think there's a whole nother faction of people in the United States and Europe who are saying, look, this guy is he's just not playing ball the way we want him to play ball. And I believe that's connected to Rishi Sunak's trip to Kiev. Because in my opinion, whenever there is a problem with Zelensky, whenever he veers off course, whether he wants to create a treaty with Russia, whether he wants to negotiate, whether he wants to escalate, it doesn't matter in which direction. But whenever he veers off course, a British prime minister is sent to Kiev, which Absolutely. Implicates the UK in a very bad, bad way. It just shows how dug in they are with Ukraine. It seems like they can't get out of this mess. They won't be able to extract themselves from this.
I agree with that on every count. By the way, I said something very similar in a video I did about Sunak. I'll come to Sunak in a moment, because I discussed his visit yesterday in my own program yesterday. But first of all, I agree. I think there is growing frustration about Zelensky. I mean, it goes back some weeks. We had that strange article which appeared, which said that he and Biden had a row over the phone back in June. Why break that up all over again, given, you know, that now we're in October? Well, when it was published, I think it was early November. So why rake that all up again? But then again, he veered off course over the Ukrainian missile strike. There's growing, as you said, exasperation with him. You had Sullivan visiting him in Kiev, apparently to read him some kind of, you know, lesson, telling him you can't take a stance of refusing to negotiate under any circumstances at all. And apparently he wasn't happy. And now, and I think it's about the most concerning thing of all for Zelensky, actually, in terms of the public criticism that he's getting, in that officials of his own government, of the Ukrainian government, are contradicting him. Because he gave an address to a conference in Halifax in the United States, a virtual address, which was also, by the way, attended by the US Defense Secretary, Lloyd Austin. And Zelensky said over the course of that virtual address that the Russians had offered a short truce. And now Ukrainian officials are coming along and saying this isn't true at all. Russians have never made any such offer. And so in other words, they're actually coming out and saying that Zelensky has lied twice. So, I mean, he's lied a few days ago over the missile. Now he's lying again over the story of the short truce. He's been slapped down repeatedly. And the visit by Sunak is really so interesting, because when Boris Johnson went to Kiev, it was big news. I mean, you know, in Britain, it was the big lead story. The media covered it heavily. There was pictures of the two, Zelensky and Johnson together. You know, it was a kind of love fest between the two. When Liz Truss went to Kiev, it was big news in a kind of a way. With Sunak going to Kiev, there's barely news at all. There's hardly, I mean, the coverage has been very, very slight. And he came with a miserable arms package, £150 million, which is, as I said, chicken feed in relation to what's been going on in Ukraine. And, of course, some media outlets reported that he said that Britain would back Ukraine until it won. Except, of course, when you actually looked at Sunak's words, he didn't say that at all. He said that Britain would back Ukraine until it won the peace and security it deserved, which is quite a subtle difference, actually. I mean, you know, they deleted those other words. But the point was, we didn't get very much information about what Sunak actually said to Zelensky. And the pictures of the two that I saw, they didn't look particularly friendly or particularly close. So I think that he was sent again from London, exactly as you said, by the collective West, by the ascendant faction in Washington. And they basically came to Kiev, and he basically told Zelensky, can't quiet him down, you know, want a period of silence from you. And, you know, we are getting increasingly tired and frustrated with you and the way in which you're behaving increasingly erratically and going off course. And of course, Sunak is a good person to say that, because on the one hand, he doesn't have the personal commitment to Ukraine and to Zelensky that, say, Boris Johnson did. But at the same time, as you said, Britain is a major player in Ukrainian affairs. And of course, it's the primary ally of the United States, the primary military ally of the United States. So I suspect that was the message Sunak came to Kiev to deliver, basically to tell Zelensky, look, you're on borrowed time. You either behave yourself, you either stay on script, or we're looking out for other people to take your place. And by the way, there was a long piece about in the Financial Times about General Zaluzhny, which came out at about the same time. That's the Ukrainian commander-in-chief, about the same time as Sunak was in Kiev.
You think they're preparing Zaluzhny, or there's a faction in the collective West that may be inching towards Zaluzhny?
Yeah, the other leadership. Person that The other person some people are talking about is Yermak, who is one of Zelensky's one of Zelensky's officials. And it was Yermak who actually came out and said, you know, that the Russians never did offer the short truce. So it could be Zelensky, it could be Yermak, it could be someone else. This, by the way, I tend to do this, and, you know, I hope people will bear with me, but this is a little bit, it's starting to resemble a little bit what happened in South Vietnam. In South Vietnam, when the United States first committed itself to supporting South Vietnam in the early 60s, the president of South Vietnam was a very erratic and eccentric, but in some ways rather interesting man called Ngon Dinh Diem. And the Americans eventually found that he was always veering off script, and he wasn't doing the kind of things that the Americans wanted. And eventually, they teamed up with the South Vietnamese military, and they staged a coup, over the course of which Diem himself was killed, together with other members of his family. And the military in South Vietnam took over. Most people, looking back, now see that as a mistake, that this was something that actually weakened the political structures in South Vietnam. But, you know, this is, affair in Ukraine is beginning to have some similarities to this, in that people are getting increasingly frustrated with Zelensky. They found him erratic. They find him inefficient. They find that he doesn't have the ability to keep a steady course. And at the same time, he's perhaps too committed to one of the Washington factions as opposed to others. And one does get the sense that there's sort of a growing hardening of feelings against him. I mean, the fact that Newsweek is also publishing pieces about him also suggests that, frankly.
Yeah, I think one of the big problems that the collective West has with Zelensky is they've made him into such a hero. They've built him up so much that they were finding themselves in a position where it would have been impossible from a media and PR optics standpoint to get rid of him, because they've turned him into such a hero deliberately. They've built him up almost too much. And there are people, yes, in the collective West that actually buy into this. And they actually believe this guy is some sort of heroic figure. Go figure. But the missile strike in Poland, whether it was a false flag, whether it was an accident, deliberate, it doesn't really matter at this point in time, at least in my opinion, because I think it's opened up the door to the collective West to now paint Zelensky as a World War III loving maniac,
yes,
a liar, a person who's unhinged, a person that wants to trick the world into nuclear Armageddon. I mean, this is what this missile has done for various factions in the collective West, if they want to capitalize on it. And we're seeing some of them actually, yeah, capitalize on this. And yeah, they are starting to talk about how this guy, Zelensky, he was this great president and hero of Ukraine, but he's kind of gone off the deep end now, and he's trying to trick us and lie us into World War III. So this guy is dangerous. This man is very dangerous. We have to do something about it. So it has opened the door there, and a good off-ramp for factions in the collective West that would like to extract themselves from this conflict, a good off-ramp would be to replace Zelensky. That could open the door to some sort of a renewed attempt to a ceasefire, to a negotiation. It's very much for me, it's kind of like if you want to understand what the collective West is thinking, then look at the way they're projecting. So all the time they said Putin must go in order for us to have peace. What they really mean is Zelensky must go in order for us to have peace. And just on a final note, Stoltenberg said this the other day. He said, NATO wants to achieve an acceptable peace agreement for Ukraine, so it is necessary to increase military assistance to Kiev. Military assistance, whatever. He's going to say that. But it seems like he's come back around full circle as to where he was in 3-4 months ago, where he says, now we're just fighting to create an acceptable peace. Yes. Let's usher Zelensky out. Let's continue to give them more weapons. We can then say we've helped Ukraine get to an acceptable place for an acceptable peace, and maybe we can extract ourselves. I don't know. Maybe that could be something. Yeah, actually, I'm positive that some people are thinking like that. Not the majority, but there are some people.
That is exactly correct. And I'm pretty sure, by the way, that the military people and some of the economic people are saying this. They're saying this has gone disastrously wrong. You promised us regime change in Moscow. It hasn't happened. We're facing a very severe recession in Europe. I'm not going to go over again the situation in Britain. All you need to do is to go to the British newspapers, including the Conservative newspapers, to see how grim the mood in Britain has become at the moment. I mean, the way in which the country is basically facing now is locked into decline. So, I mean, they all see this. The military are worried about the fact that their armories are becoming depleted. The economic people are worried about the general states of the economy and that the fact that Ukraine is going to cost a bomb, more than that. And still others are worried about the fact that it looks increasingly as if the Ukrainian economy is going to collapse, what's left of it, and we're going to have 8 million Ukrainian refugees pouring into the West at a time when there's no mood to take in refugees in Europe, and that could reignite all sorts of political problems in the West as well. And there are still other people who are saying this man is incredibly erratic. We have a World War III type scenario just over the horizon. We must find a way out. So you can see that all of these people are probably talking to each other, saying all of these things. They're saying to themselves, how do we get out? How do we extract ourselves from Ukraine, get a kind of peace with honour type situation? Remember all that language from Vietnam and all that? So peace with honour? Well, Zelensky's never going to deliver it. He's too erratic. He's too irresponsible. He's too unbalanced. So let's get him out of the way and let's put in his place somebody like Yermak, who looks altogether more sober and more reliable and more sound. And I'm going to make a guess. I think there's a whole group of other people who are saying, we've also got to get rid of Zelensky. And the reason we've got to get rid of Zelensky is because we want to keep the war going. And we want a more efficient and militant and hardline leader in Ukraine. And we can't give up now because we've invested so much and we're sending our own people there in the guise of contractors. But we don't think that Zelensky is the right person to run things because, quite frankly, he's completely incompetent. So we also want to get rid of Zelensky, but we want to get rid of Zelensky and replace him with Zelensky, who's a more hardline, more reliable, more efficient sort of person. So I suspect that there are both of those factions in the West. And then there's a third faction which says, you know, let's just leave things as they are, keep our fingers crossed, hope the Russians get tired. If we try and oust Zelensky at this moment in time, it's going to cause the whole thing to tumble and collapse. So let's, how erratic and irresponsible he is, let's leave him in place. And let's just keep our fingers crossed and hope that somehow something happens over the next few couple of months or year or whatever, and that we find our way out. So I suspect all those factions are arguing it out and manoeuvring. But I think overall, it's the first faction, the faction of the economic technocrats, the military people, those sort of people, the ones who say we've got ourselves into a terrible hole in Ukraine. We've got to find a way out. I think that they are in the ascendant. And Stoltenberg's words, which you quoted about an acceptable peace, are very interesting because they're essentially the same ones that Sunak used over the course of his trip to Kiev. Sunak said, we will continue to support Ukraine until it's won the kind of peace and security that it deserves. So, very different from saying an acceptable peace. Acceptable to whom, however? To the Russians? To the Ukrainian hardliners? Is this even really an option? Well, we'll just have to see.
Yeah, and the collective West always has the media that they could spin it into any shape or direction they want. They can make a terrible loss in Ukraine look like an acceptable piece to their viewers in the collective West. So, I mean, you know, they do have the soft power to shape those yes. words, acceptable yes. peace in the yes. public's eyes. Do you believe that the rumors that Russia is preparing to knock out the entire electric grid of Ukraine in December and January, and they're also going to knock out much of the gas infrastructure, and the rumors to go along with what I just said are that the Kremlin has relayed this to Ukraine, and they've told them this is pretty much your last chance to come to some sort of an agreement.
I think it's plausible. I mean, obviously, I mean, you know, again, we always say this. We don't know what is going on inside the Kremlin. I mean, we really don't know. But it's plausible. I mean, it's consistent with the pattern of what they've been doing over the last few weeks since October, these massive missile strikes that they've been launching every couple of days, knocking out more and more of the energy infrastructure. They went after the gas infrastructure for the first time the other day, and not in a big way, but in a way that suggests that, you know, more might be coming in that direction. And last but not least, and I harp on this, I also believe that at some point, if they do launch this big all-out missile offensive, they'll also go for the bridges across the Dnieper River. I know that there are people who are sceptical about this, but I don't see why they wouldn't, personally. And I think they do have the capability to knock out these bridges. So they can do all of that. And, of course, they've got 400,000 men plus joining their military, and apparently large amounts of weapons are moving in that kind of direction. And, you know, we have American military commentators, Scott Ritter, Daniel Davis, Douglas McGregor. They're all telling us that it's the quiet before the storm, and this big, massive Russian offensive is coming, and it'll be both a missile, an economic offensive, and a military one. And it seems to me that that's the most likely. I mean, why wouldn't the Russians want to do those things? And it's quite clear, it's become increasingly clear now, that Ukraine isn't going to get the anti-missile defences from the West that are needed to counter this. And in fact, those anti-missile defences don't exist. So the West can't supply them anyway.
On just a final note, we'll wrap the video up. If the Russians do that, I think we're one of the only channels that has really discussed the refugee implications with regards to the EU. If the Russians do take out the entire electric grid, everything in Ukraine, then the EU is going to have a catastrophic refugee crisis.
Yes.
Right on there. I mean, it's going to hit in ways that 2015 just, you know, it's you're not going to be able to compare it. That's how bad it's going to be.
That's entirely right.
With the taking out of Ukraine's entire electric grid, not only do you demolish the Ukraine economy, I mean, you push the European Union towards the brink of collapse as well. Do you not? Or
yeah, absolutely. I mean, first of all, I mean, we must understand something, which is that the Ukrainian energy system is connected with that of Eastern Europe, because the Soviets built it that way. I mean, the Soviets built the Ukrainian energy system up in a way that it would also provide electricity to Eastern Europe. So Eastern Europe and Ukraine are integrated to a great degree through their energy systems. So if you destroy the Ukrainian energy system, you're going to have an impact on the energy systems in Eastern Europe. And that's, of course, going to have another knock-on effect beyond that on the whole European economy. The European economy, well, we've talked about it so often in these programs. I mean, we don't need to repeat ourselves. It's in a terrible mess. We now have people like Macron and Habeck complaining angrily about the fact that the United States is expropriating European industries. They're complaining about the Anti-Inflation Act that Biden has published, has, you know, en- enacted, that this is enticing European companies to move from Europe to the United States. I'm not going to even start commenting about Habeck and Macron, the kind of things that they've done and how they're responsible for these situations. But throw on top of that mix a refugee flow which will dwarf the one of 2015. As I remember, 2015, we were talking about around 1 million refugees. This would be, well, the most conservative number I've seen is 8 million. If you're going to have the entire population of the cities, Kiev and co, moving west. And of course, if Ukraine implodes, if there's a complete collapse, if that spreads to the western regions of Ukraine, if people, say, in western Ukraine start to fear that the Russians are coming back, and, you know, in western Ukraine, a lot of people really hate the Russians, we have to say that, and they might decide that they want to move to the west as well. So it could be many more than 8 million. Well, at a time when Europe is in severe economic distress, far greater than it was in 2015, you're going to send a tidal wave of people from Ukraine to Europe at a time when already in countries like Poland, Italy, Germany, there's increasing exasperation with the behaviour of some of the refugees that are already there. Well, I mean, I just doesn't bear even thinking about. I mean, it would be a calamity. And the extraordinary thing is, the European Union is doing absolutely nothing that I can see to prepare for this. They have no plan. They have no idea what they're going to do. They have no concept of holding centres or anything of this kind. It's just one of those things that looks so terrifying that they don't want to even think about it. And the trouble is, that's not a policy. That's not a strategy. If it comes, they will have to think about it. And you're quite right. At that point, we're going to see a massive crisis in the EU. You have countries, the frontline states, Poland, Germany perhaps, Romania conceivably, demanding that the Slovakia, Hungary, demanding that the burden be shared. You'll have massive pushback from Italy and France and all sorts of other places. I mean, the rows that are going to happen are just beyond, again, anything that one can really calculate or estimate or even understand. And the same is true in Britain, by the way. I mean, we have had Ukrainian refugees in Britain. There's already apparently growing impatience amongst many British people about the presence of some of these people. But of course, that's a trickle compared to the flood that may come.
Yeah, the Russians realize this, though. I mean,
of course they do. Of course they do. They know this perfectly well. I mean, they know. I mean, Alex, can I come back to that? I thought one of the most prescient things that anybody's ever said about this crisis. You said this all the way back, well before the war began. You said, "What a hill to die on, Ukraine! What a hill NATO has chosen to die on, which is Ukraine. They could have negotiated solutions to this problem. They could have moved to activate Minsk II when then that was still an option. They could have agreed with the Russians that Ukraine will always remain neutral, that there's no chance of it ever becoming a NATO member state. They could have done any of those things. They did none of those things because they pursued this regime change agenda in Moscow. They thought they were laying a trap for the Russians in Ukraine. And they laid a trap for themselves. And as I said, if millions of people come their way, which is predictable, it's completely predictable. The Russians, of course, know it. The Europeans must know it. If it happens, well, as I said, it'll be a calamity that European leaders have brought on to Europe. They brought it on to the onto Europe themselves.
I mean, I say it. The reason I bring it up is because every day I'm getting articles from the Ukraine energy company, DTEC, I believe it's whatever them is called. The CEO from the BBC, the CEO is giving interviews and he's saying Ukrainians that are living in cities, in these cities, Kiev and Odessa, Lviv, get out. We're telling you, go somewhere else for 3, 4, 5, 6 months. I mean, that's what the CEO of the Ukrainian energy firm is saying. He is telling people of Ukraine to go find somewhere to live for 6 months.
Yeah.
And I just wondered to myself, where do these people go? What do you mean, go find somewhere to live for 6 months? It's crazy talk.
I mean, it's not crazy. It's totally sensible. We know what he means. He means go to Europe. It's the only place. I mean, they're not going to go to the Ukrainian villages. I mean, however, whatever people say about you, that isn't a practical option. You can't. These villages can't sustain, you know, the 10, 8, 10, 15 million people we're talking about. We're talking about the bulk of the population of Ukraine. They will go to Europe. There is no other place. And you're absolutely right. I mean, I was reading, you know, the mayor of Ivano-Frankivsk, one of the Western Ukrainian cities. He was telling anybody who lives above the ground floor in one of these big apartment buildings, you should leave because, you know, the lifts might not be working before long. And of course, as you know, in the Soviet, ex-Soviet world, most people live in high-rise apartment buildings. So if he's telling everybody who lives above the ground floor to leave, that's most of the population of Ivano-Frankivsk.
Okay. We will leave it there at theduran.locals.com and go to the Duran shop, 10% off, use the code GOODDAY. Take care.